Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Hey, good Monday afternoon to you. I'm Neil Stavem, sitting in for Bill Arnold. Afternoons with Bill in an abbreviated form this week. Bill's taking some time off. We're running some great previous interviews that Bill has had with guests like Vince Miller. Great hour last hour. Hope that you had a chance to catch it. And if not, you'll want to go back and check it out on the podcast at myfaithradio.com. We have great guests scheduled for this hour. We're going to get to them in a moment. Rebecca, thank you for letting me sit in here, Bill, and we'll make our way through the hour.
You're always welcome, Neil.
I was just noticing, reading about the rains in Hawaii, Hurricane Lane, over 4 feet. That's a lot of rain.
It's hard to comprehend, at least for my Midwestern brain.
It is a lot of rain, but it was just a year ago, Hurricane Harvey dumped over 5 feet of rain.
I suppose that's true. It has been a year already.
Reading Jeremiah Johnston wrote a little piece about that. He and his family had to evacuate in the middle of the night and all that. He's going to be on later this week. We'll maybe get an update on that. And, of course, there's floods of news coverage continuing about the president. And now, of course, we can talk about the president's views of John McCain. And on it goes. And or any other views, mainly the news cycle brings us divergent views. And so the question is, can we actually find some common ground? Can we live in a pluralistic society?
That's an excellent question.
We're going to find out here.
Oh, we have answers?
I don't know. So I've used up all my big words. And after listening to Michael Harrington here in the news, he used his all up in a minute. So in a minute, we're going to talk with John Anazu. John is a professor, distinguished professor of law and religion at Washington University in St. Louis, and author of a book called Confident Pluralism. In fact, it's being re-released in a paperback coming up. But John wrote a little article in Christianity Today just the other day about the headline being Why I'm Still Confident About Confident Pluralism. So we'll find out why and how we might share that confidence. That's our first guest here in this 4 o'clock hour Central Time on Afternoons of Bill Arnold.
Have you ever heard the right message at the right moment? Well, recently Abby wrote us to say this. I've struggled with depression, and I just wanted to let you know how you've been a huge encouragement to me. With your help, I'm learning how to give myself over to God and to let Him rule in my life. Thank you so much for your encouragement. The truth is, Abby's story would not be possible without friends like you praying and supporting this ministry. Hi, I'm Dick Whitworth, station manager for Faith Radio. Our fall share is coming September 11th, and we need your help. If you're not already a monthly contributor to this ministry, would you consider joining us? For just $30 a month, you can become a member of Team 360 and a member of the Hope Coffee Club. We'll tell you more as it gets closer, but thank you for praying even now about your involvement in Fall Share. You can start your pledge today by visiting myfaithradio.com. It's simple and safe. Thank you, and God bless you.
Well, we're 8 minutes after the hour. And if you love talking about freedom of assembly, free speech, religious freedom, other issues like that, then you're going to have a great conversation and want to listen in. And you can join in today as we talk with John Anazu. John is the Sally Danforth Distinguished Professor of Law and Religion at Washington University in St. Louis and author of a wonderful book called Confident Pluralism. The subtitle is intriguing, Surviving and Thriving Through Deep Difference. And we've got the deep difference part down. Can we survive and thrive? Is that possible? We'll talk about it in the moments ahead. By the way, if you want to call or text to join the conversation, it's 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. John, welcome to Faith Radio.
Neil, thanks so much. It's great to be back with you all.
Appreciate that. You wrote in Christianity Today just the other day that you're still confident about confident pluralism. The book came out a couple of years ago, and what you were talking about then seems to have maybe unraveled a fur piece from then. Why are you still confident?
Well, I mean, let me start just by acknowledging what I think a lot of us are feeling, which is things do seem to have gotten a lot harder even in the last couple of years. And when we think about the differences that divide us and the way we handle those differences, we don't see lots of signs of optimism there. So in saying that I'm still confident, and particularly to a Christian audience, I want to think of two things. First, we do have a history of struggling with and across difference, and we haven't been perfect, and we've often silenced other people, but we have found a kind of modest unity across that in some really hard times, and I think it's important to not forget that history. But then I think when we think of Christians in particular, maybe my beginning point is there any other option than confidence? We have confidence in our Savior, we have confidence in how the story ends, and we have confidence in really the playbook of how we're supposed to engage in the world. And so I think in some ways, if Christians can't be leading with confidence, even when times look challenging and dire, then we're not going to turn around and see others doing it for us.
Well, I guess, we like to think that these are, the worst times, no matter what, I guess, our circumstances, situation might be. But there have been other times in maybe not only our nation, but certainly globally, where there have been, difficult situations, and people have managed to come through.
No, that's right. And I don't want to minimize what many of us are experiencing now. I wake up and I read the news or hear the news, and I'm usually pretty upset by what I'm seeing and hearing. But I think we also, in the midst of that, need to remember how we're holding it together. In most cases, our words don't lead to political violence, and that hasn't been the case in many societies. And then when we think about kind of the coarseness of the rhetoric, we've kind of had parts of that all along. You can go back to the election of 1800 and see a lot that resembles 2016. And so knowing that our history has been pretty flawed along the way too, but not, also not taking for granted the moments of relative success and really learning to tell those stories a little better too.
Maybe we should just define the word a bit. What are we talking about in pluralism? And there are maybe several senses in which we need to understand it.
Sure. Yeah, it's funny. I usually try not to even use that word anymore in public talks because it is kind of a distancing or unsettling word sometimes. But the basic idea is we have to begin with the fact of very deep and real differences in society. So we have to acknowledge that we disagree on some pretty fundamental matters, and that makes all kinds of complications for naming something like the common good of the country or trying to talk about our values collectively, because it's really less apparent what those might be. So we have this fact of difference, and then the question related to that is, what do we do about it? And so you can think of an approach of pluralism as a way to live into that difference as an alternative to just retreating to our own echo chambers or to clashing in either violent or dismissive ways, and to say we're stuck with the difference. How do we live together across that difference? And I'll say, too, that I think, and I wouldn't be making this argument if I didn't believe, that we can do this without surrendering our convictions. So this is not at all a call for relativism or suggesting that all views out there are the same or that our differences don't matter. I think you and I and lots of people listening in would say our views absolutely matter. They have eternal consequences. And so it's prioritizing the ability to live out and say that what we believe matters, but also doing that graciously with those who disagree.
Can we find a rally around a common good any longer, as you said? I think you may have talked about modest unity. I mean, that feels sort of like that's not really the best we could do.
Well, right. I mean, and so in some ways, modest unity sets up a fairly low bar. The good news is sometimes the bar feels low enough that anything in the right direction would be a success of sorts. I do think we can claim a vocabulary. It starts with things like the Constitution or ideas or principles that are accessible to Christians and non-Christians alike. How do we treat each other under the law? How do we treat each other in civic spaces? Can we be kind and respectful of each other? And all of that, which might seem thin and perhaps not that significant over time, does build a kind of collective narrative. I think it's harder, though, when we think about how to maintain this on a national level. And so sometimes I think our best cases are actually much more local, where we're actually putting names and faces with viewpoints across difference.
Is it happening locally and we're just not sort of hearing about it, or because so much of what's going on in D.C. where there's kind of deep divides that are being fueled, you know, by a 24-hour news cycle, is that, and so are we maybe in better shape than we think?
Well, it's happening locally for sure, and I think we're not great about telling those stories because in some ways they feel more ordinary, and maybe we have to get really local. We have to maybe go down to the neighborhood level. So politics can often be unsettling and maybe the place where we expect to see this the least these days, but at the local neighborhood level and as people work across issues that they can't avoid, you know, a road that needs to be fixed or a school where kids are sent, we start to find more kinds of partnerships. And that doesn't at all mean we've got it solved at the local level. So we still have massive issues of school segregation and neighborhood inequities and those sorts of things. But I think if we're going to start somewhere, it has to be with real people and real faces.
Has this come about because we've sort of lost, I mean, the major institutions aren't, whether it's politics or education or maybe even religion, just doesn't have the maybe the place of authority that it used to or the respect that it used to?
I think that's absolutely part of it. There's a sense in which even the commitment to institutions seems a bit suspect. And I want to say immediately, perhaps with good reason, we've seen, you know, even in the last few weeks, massive abuses of authority in institutions that asked people to trust them for a long time. And so in some ways, there has to be kind of a reckoning with existing institutions, both in and outside of the church, to say, where are power abuses happening and how do we think through those critically and truthfully? And at the same time, I think we need to welcome people into communities and institutions and churches and groups that we can't expect to solve our challenges or repair the social fabric as a bunch of individuals. We're going to need groups and institutions and organizations to make that possible.
John Anazu is the Sally Danforth Distinguished Professor of Law and Religion at Washington University in St. Louis, author of the book Confident Pluralism, Surviving and Thriving Through Deep Difference. In a moment, we'll talk about some aspirations that we can take to bring about or at least lead the way here, some issues of patience, humility, tolerance, and, of course, as Christians, we have hope. We'll talk about all that and more in the moments ahead. You want to join the conversation, you can call or text 877-933-2484. Afternoons, Bill Arnold underway. I'm Neil Stabem, sitting in for Bill this afternoon, talking with John Anazu, who's a professor at the University at Washington University in St. Louis. And are kids back in class, John? Are you started courses, or are you doing writing this semester?
Today is the first day of classes, so I taught my first class this morning.
Okay, and you still remember how to do it?
It's like riding a bike.
Okay, good. All right. So I got a few scrapes on the knees. And no, we're glad to have you on us today talking about confident pluralism, surviving and thriving through deep differences. Of course, a lot of reflection this weekend, the loss of John McCain, who was certainly lived up to his name many times, Maverick. I mean, he had you know, strong convictions, deep differences within his own party oftentimes. How do we deal with that where it seems like we, you know, we should be united around maybe a greater cause, and then you have a maverick like John McCain?
Right. Well, he's such an interesting example, isn't he? Because he was so confident in his own convictions, but he also had a bit of humility that was willing to say when he was wrong, and even that is pretty rare these days, and perhaps a timely reminder of his impact on other people is the extent to which he's getting bipartisan praise, not just, you know, on his passing, which often happens, but on his ability to pursue friendship and relationship across difference. And so that's a real example of how you can be strong in your convictions and still find those relationships across difference. Not to say he got it perfect, but he was in a pretty hard space and managed to make it work much of the time.
And you talk about, you know, we need to figure out how to practice civic friendship with one another, and that's going to require a great deal of effort. And I know you talk about a few aspirations that would maybe send us on the path. Say a bit more about those three aspirations.
Sure, and I refer to these as tolerance, humility, and patience. And I mean these as general guides for how we might engage with others across difference. So let me start with humility, actually. And what I mean by that is just a recognition that people are not always going to understand the logic of our arguments from A to Z, that we begin with very different foundational beliefs, and it's going to take time and relationship sometimes to persuade other people, and sometimes we might not be able to. And this is very different than, say, a 1980s approach to apologetics, which suggested, you know, if I can only get you into the logical progression of my argument for faith, you'll come to faith as well. And I think we're realizing that that's much harder to do today. So can we enter into discussions and relationships with a posture of humility that doesn't say, I'm skeptical of my own beliefs, we can hold those confidently, but it might say, I recognize the ability of my argumentative reason here. And then patience sort of goes alongside that, and it says we have to be in relationships and conversations in an effort to listen and to understand and to empathize, and sometimes that's going to take time and creative imagination, and maybe we shouldn't be doing it if we're just trying to check a box. We need to treat people as the image bearers that they are. And then finally, tolerance. And here, this is maybe the trickiest word these days, because tolerance on a lot of college campuses means you have to accept me fully, believe everything I do and what I think. And I think that's actually a misguided way to think of tolerance. I think tolerance is much closer to something like a practical enduring of another belief or viewpoint, that you don't have to accept the belief, but you move toward the person. And then as Christians especially, that if our tolerance is rooted out of our love for God and neighbor, that we're actually doing something even far more lavish than merely tolerating someone, so that we move toward friendships with a kind of love and desire to enter into relationship. And then when people reject us, well, we have an answer for that too. We're told to love our enemies and sacrifice when we engage with them. And so, you know, we have the playbook, we just need to execute. And I think we can do that without capitulating or without worrying about the company that we're keeping, but really just trying to witness to the love of God across difference.
As you talk about in the article, you talk about, you know, the aspirations is going to take us so far. We want to transform these into virtues. And really, as believers, I mean, we should always be pursuing that, right? Relationships and the moving toward the person, all those should be the natural direction we're headed.
Right, and maybe that starts just practicing that in-house. So, you know, are we having and are we creating spaces for real conversations about our own disagreements with each other? And are we allowing for those disagreements to be voiced? And then are we handling those in a way that looks attractive to those around us? When we bicker with each other, it can often be an indictment against our own witness.
Been reading in Corinthians lately, and you know, Paul talking about having the responsibility, the ministry of reconciliation. You know, that we're Christ's ambassadors, and that's a pretty significant calling and a significant term, isn't it? That we should try and be that same level of reconciliation that God did through Christ for us.
It's a tremendous responsibility, you know, and right after that, Paul writes, as if we were standing in the place of Christ and of God, and so that we are there as his, in his place in some ways, you know, at the foreground of relationships, and to reconcile and really to bear and to endure. I was just looking at Revelation the past few days and the call over and over again to patient endurance, that's also part of the Christian life and our engagement with others.
Well, you're on a campus where you know, universities are known for their safe places now. So enduring isn't really the first call, I guess, is it? We don't want to hear what we don't want to hear.
Well, in some ways, and I'll be the first to admit that at a place like mine, there are plenty of sort of crazy stories that come around. But I also, you know, especially for Christians, want to say, you know, for the campuses out there that seem secular or hostile or combative, to look past some of those instances and to look for the people who are there in ministry, who are there in the evangelistic sense, and who are there really to welcome strangers and friends alike. And I actually find my own day-to-day at a place like my university to be quite welcoming and a tremendous opportunity to engage with people who are like me and also with other Christians who are looking for community and encouragement.
If we don't take if we don't take the challenge to survive and thrive through deep difference, what's the outcome? I mean, you wrote this book, first came out, what, a couple of years ago, and I know you got just the new paperback release out. Is it this week or soon?
Just out a couple of weeks ago,
yeah.
Right.
So, I mean, if we don't maybe take up this challenge, will we just see a continued, separation?
Or worse, right? So I think we don't want to take for granted the relative stability we have in this country. And I think the more that we choose not to risk trust with other people, and the more that we retreat to echo chambers, and the more that we begin to see people on the other side of issues, not just as people we disagree with, but as people who are evil or out of bounds, the more we're going to set ourselves up for, I think, real social harm. And that's happening in lots of directions. And so I think our call as Christians is to be peacemakers and to be people who will say, we're going to start with recognizing that we are with other image bearers who need light, grace, and truth, and that we work to pursue that.
Yeah, and just in the final minute, I guess just a reminder again that Christians have hope, right? Our theology is rooted in hope. That should fill us and motivate us in fresh ways.
Hope is a tremendous resource that should give us all kinds of ability and steer us toward those aspirations of patience, humility, and tolerance.
John Anazu, great to visit with you again. Thanks for coming back on Faith Radio, and wish you a great year ahead as you teach and lead and write.
Thanks so much, Neil. Great to talk to you.
The book, Confident Pluralism, Surviving and Thriving Through Deep Difference, just was re-released in paperback, so you can look for that where books are sold and find out more about John's writing. John has authored Liberty's Refuge as well, and he speaks on topics of pluralism and free speech, freedom of assembly, religious freedom, other issues on that range. He's the Sally Danforth Distinguished Professor of Law and Religion at Washington University in St. Louis. And joining us today here on the Afternoons with Bill Arnold, I'm Neil Stabem, sitting in for Bill, and appreciate the opportunity to chat with John Anazu today. It's a recommended reading. Check that out, Confident Pluralism, Surviving and Thriving Through Deep Difference. We're going to talk a little bit about coming up in the next half hour, how to not just survive but thrive in the back-to-school mode, and help our kids have success, not only in how they're eating, but maybe just their regimen and responsibility and all that. Lisa Marone, who is one of our favorite physical therapists, an author, professor, and speaker, will be coming on with us here in just a few minutes. So, again, if you have some questions, you want to react to John Anazu's conversation, you can give us a call or text at 877-93-FAITH. Or if you had a question for Lisa Marone, you can queue up for that as well. We'll be back in just a moment. Thanks for tuning in to Faith Radio. I'm Neil Stabem, sitting in for Bill Arnold this afternoon. Bill taking some time off. Happy to be plugged in the afternoons with you. And looking forward to connecting with Lisa Marone in just a moment. And we're going to talk about, back to school and healthy habits. And really, it's a good time for all of us to get healthy, for heaven's sake. In fact, that's the title of one of Lisa's books and really what motivates her in her work as a physical therapist, author, a professor, and speaker, and we'll talk about that in a moment. I also want to just open up the phones. If you have a question related to your health, love to have you interact with us at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. Back with Lisa Marone in a minute.
A horse is a horse, of course. For the Colson Center, I'm John Stone Street with The Point. The Washington Post recently reported about an abused horse in Oregon named Justice. Its former owner is being sued by Justice for $100,000 in damages. Now, Christians recognize God's directive to man to care for the creation. We should never abuse animals. It's terrible the way Justice was treated. But Justice is a horse, not a person with a standing to sue. Can't tell that to animal rights lawyers. Their worldview tells them there's no moral or ontological difference between humans and animals. Our resistance to animal personhood is a sign of our bigotry, they say, a bigotry called speciesism. So they'll be shopping cases like Justice the Horse around until they get a judge to take it. And Oregon, with some of the most progressive animal rights laws, is a good target. Nonetheless, I wonder how Justice might fare under cross-examination. He's no Mr. Ed, after all. For more on faith and culture, come to Breakpoint.org. I'm John Stone Street.
It's the countdown to spring.
Here we are at 33 past the hour and looking forward to talking with Lisa Marone. Lisa is a physical therapist, author and professor and speaker, president and founder of Restoring Your Temple, LLC. And her message of healing has been developed through 20 plus years of experience in the field of orthopedic physical rehab. And she's written a number of books, including Get Healthy for Heaven's Sake. And we're looking forward to talking about some good health habits, as always, with Lisa. Lisa recently moved to a different part of the country. And welcome, by the way. Good to have you on back on Faith Radio, Lisa.
Yeah, it's always great to be with you.
Did I did move
quite far.
And did that...
I moved from Long Island, New York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from Long Island to Virginia?
To Central Virginia. So I'm in the mountains now. I used to be on the beach, so it's quite a different area.
So, you know, when someone does a transition like that, I mean, you've had lots of years of, you know, your favorite grocery stores. You probably had your favorite walking trails, mm-hmm. all those kinds of things. Maybe what's been the biggest adjustment, maybe just from an overall health and fitness perspective?
You know, that's a great question, Neil, because one of the biggest adjustments coming from Long Island was me finding a good source of fresh fish, a fresh fish that wasn't farm-raised. And so I had to drive about 20 minutes from my house in order to find someone who actually had fish that was naturally caught and ready for sale. So that was one of the biggest challenges for me. But the farmers markets down here and the proximity to farms and fresh-raised cattle and things like that are on the market here is a greater abundance. So I'm finding an easier time finding fresh fruits and vegetables, and they do actually taste much better than, I guess, the time it took them to truck it through Manhattan and onto Long Island.
Yeah, it's all the turnpikes in Jersey, right? Just trying to, it's paying all those tolls. If they could have just gone straight through, it would have been fine.
It is. It's got much more expensive also by the time it hit the shelves, for
true.
Sure.
Well, let's start talking a little bit about food, because we thought we'd talk about, you know, back to school time, you know, whether kids have already gone, children or grandchildren, or it's coming soon. And all of us really, it's kind of the time we all get back into maybe a little better routine and want to help our kids, you know, fuel for success, but really all of us should be paying attention to that too. So let's talk about fueling for success. What do we need to know about getting our kids off to a good start this year?
Yeah, you know, I wish I knew now what I knew, I wish I knew then what I know now about my kids. My children are 24 and 22 years old, and when I first sent them out to school with their lunch boxes filled, they had cookies in there and they had little bags of potato chips and they had juice boxes and all of the things that I'm going to today say, please don't do that to your children, because we need to fuel our children better from the get-go. We know that they love to eat sweet and salty and all of that, but they can't be the mainstay of their diet. And so it's really important from the beginning of the day, before you even get them out on the bus, Neil, is to start them off with a healthy breakfast. And I know some of our kids aren't used to eating breakfast, or maybe you throw a granola bar at them or give them a little squeezing yogurt stick. But all of those things are so high in sugar, Neil, that we're starting our kids off with this super sugar spike, and we're creating insulin resistance in our six-year-olds already.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we can maybe get into that, too, just in terms of a whole generation of kids that are maybe dealing with some weight issues and not really as healthy as they should be. But say more about what are the, you know, if we're not sending the chips and the white bread sandwiches and those things, what should we be sending our kids?
Yeah, I think it's really important that we give our kids choices and things that look exciting for them to eat. And so they have to be things that, if you're sending them with fruit and vegetables, don't send them with a whole apple. They'll likely throw it in the garbage. So you might want to cut up that apple and toss it with a little bit of lemon juice so it doesn't brown. But have something like a nut butter, an almond butter, or peanut butter for them to dip it in. Cut up vegetables for them. And then lean proteins. You know, on the weekend when you're at home, throw a large turkey breast in the oven and then just slice that thing up and use it for days. On sandwiches and even in lettuce wraps and things like that. We kind of have this traditional sandwich idea in our heads. But putting things on white bread is not a good idea for our kids. It's almost like you've packed their sandwich in two loaves of marshmallows. That's the way our body sees it. And so it's really a good idea to get some lean proteins in there. Even shelled hard-boiled eggs are a great quick lunch for our kids. But the bologna sandwiches and the salami sandwiches, that's not a great thing for our children anymore. Science has shown, because every teaspoon of sugar, or every 4 grams of sugar, I should say, has 1 teaspoon of sugar in it. So if you send them with one of those small little yogurts and you think, oh, yogurt, that's healthy, it usually has upwards of 20 grams of sugar, and that's 5 teaspoons of sugar, Neil. So none of us would spoon that into our kids' mouths, but we do give them that yogurt with just about that much sugar in it.
You know, I mean, kids need calories, right? I mean, they just, their motors are burning all the time, so they need a lot of fuel. So is it okay if we're, you know, if it's not always high test all the time, just to be pushing calories?
Well, you know, pushing calories, Neil, can be high test. So we can give them nuts. We can give them avocados. We can give them things that have a lot of calorie to them, but are just healthy calories, you know, instead of empty calories. So high calories, you can't just give them potato chips and the Oreo cookies and things like that. For my children, you know, I didn't not give them sweets. You know, once I understood about sugars, what I did when they came home, I'd say, hey, we need to have a healthy snack first, and then we're going to have a sweet snack after that. And so the sweet snack was portioned. If the cookie bag said serving size is one of these cookies or two of those cookies, I did give my children that, but it was after they filled up with something healthy first, so that they weren't just wanting 7 cookies, you know, and just, you know, pounding down a sleeve of Oreos.
Yeah, I'm kind of meddling again, Lisa, which always happens when we talk. I don't know why that is, but I became acquainted with a little Klondike bar this summer, and so now we need to talk about getting back in shape here. That's a side conversation. You did mention, you know, giving them something good first, and I know we've talked in the past about there is actually some real value in the ways in which we eat, too. I know, right? So if we eat a banana, we pair it with some sun butter or peanut butter, right?
Absolutely. So a banana is not a good snack in and of itself. It's a real sugar spiker. So half a banana with a smear of peanut butter on it, much better thing. If you're going to have a bowl of strawberries, your kid might love strawberries. You know, put a little bit of whipped cream on that. Even though it has a touch of sugar in that, that fat, or give them a handful of almonds, those fats are going to slow that sugar spike down. And so with our kids, because they're starting to become insulin resistant at such a young age, we're really setting them up for a lifetime of trouble. It's pretty amazing that 20% of our kids are considered to be obese, not just overweight, but obese, Neil, today. So that's 1 in 5 kids. That's already like way behind the eight ball in terms of health.
Well, let's transition to that then. I mean, obviously, all of us need to get moving a bit. What are some encouragement for helping kids of all sizes and ages to get mm-hmm. active?
Yeah, Neil, what I did with my children was there was a few ways that I did this. One of the ways was I made physical activity, a family event. Your kids, when they're younger, they do want to spend time with you. And so after dinner, a bike ride or a walk through the woods or something where they were doing something with us, my husband and I, was always a treat for them. And so mimicking or modeling, I should say, what you want your kids to do. another thing that I did was I made sure that when my kids were active, say they were on a soccer team or what have you, that on the times that they were waiting or they were waiting for a sibling on a soccer team, I wasn't feeding them empty calorie snacks, and I wasn't feeding them, period, because I didn't want them to think that just because there's a pause in activity, you should be putting something in your mouth. And so when our kids are moving and they're finally burning off calories, it's really good to make sure that what they're eating isn't loading them back up in calories, and even, Neil, what they're drinking. So bringing juice boxes along or soda or things like that that are super high in empty calories is really it just works against the whole activity. So have lots of water on hand. Have flavored waters, and I mean flavored without calorie, just, you know, a sparkling water that has a flavor to it. Something that makes it a little bit exciting but doesn't create an extra calorie load on them is a great thing while they're moving around.
What are your thoughts about some of these sport drinks? I mean, we, you know, obviously a lot of advertising dollars going on there. Are they, you know, are they beneficial, or are they pretty high in sugar?
They are super high in sugar. And so while we've bought into this whole electrolyte, you know, balance thing, water and a healthy snack, a bite of an apple or something, you're going to improve all of that on the sideline rather than load up on sugars. The other thing with getting kids moving, I was thinking about, you know, we really need to set limits on screen time. The Health and Human Services says today that there's kids are spending on average 7.5 hours in front of some screen every day, 7.5 hours. So if they're sitting there focused on a screen, whether it's a TV, a computer, a video game, or what have you, they're usually not moving around. So just setting limits as a family, coming to some limits on that is going to really increase their opportunity to move.
And is there a guideline in terms of moving around? I mean, just doing something's better than nothing, but how do we maximize it maybe in terms of even for us adults as well? I mean, we want to model it. So what are the kinds of amounts maybe per day or per week?
You know, I have not seen exact amounts for kids, whereas adults, there's all these studies that have been done that we should be moving with a moderate level of activity 150 minutes per week. But with kids, I would just want my children to be moving every day in some way, some purposeful way. If that means you get a basketball hoop in your yard or a can jam where they're throwing frisbees and running around, give your kids opportunities to move purposefully each day, and maybe even barter with them in terms of physical activity and screen time. So if you want to be on the screen an hour, then I want you outside playing for an hour. Something where you're giving them an incentive to do the thing that they do like playing. Well, we are a screen world now.
Yeah, no question about it. Lisa Marone, physical therapist, author, professor, speaker, written books like Get Healthy for Heaven's Sake, is with us today here on the afternoon show with Bill Arnold. I'm Neil Stavem sitting in, and we're going to take a quick little break and come back and talk more about some ways that we can maybe get into back-to-school mode, talking about, you know, eating better, exercise. We're going to deal with a couple other important areas as well, including sleep. We'll get to that in just a couple minutes. It's 48 past the hour on a Monday afternoon here on Faith Radio. I'm Neil Stavem sitting in for Bill Arnold. And on the line, Lisa Marone, physical therapist, author, professor, speaker, a good friend of Faith Radio. We're talking about ways that we can, well, get our children off to a healthy advantage as it's back to school time. And really for all of us as well, as these don't just apply to kids, but all of us need to keep things in mind about what we're eating and the kind of activities we're involved in. And one of the other key areas, Lisa, that you address is the importance of sleep. You know, I just was reading something this weekend about a football coach. They were bragging on him. He's a real go-getter. He stays up generally till about 2, and then he's up at 5 to go to the gym, and he's living on Red Bull and that kind of stuff.
Wow. Yeah, I worked for a man like that when I first got out of physical therapy school. I was in awe that he could sleep for 4 hours a night. He was, you know, developing courses and working on his master's degree and all of that. But what happens when someone runs life like that is your immune system really takes a hit, because when you're sleeping, our body heals itself and our immune system is strengthened. And unfortunately, my first boss, when he was 44 years old, was diagnosed with cancer, but we figured, hey, he's such a go-getter, he's going to just beat this thing. But in 3 months, it beat him. And I always wonder, had he been well slept and his body had been ready for the attack of cancer, could his immune system not have overcome that? And so it's really important, whether we're adults or children, that our bodies are restored at night the way that God intended it, them to be.
Of course, probably lots of kids spent the summer off hours, or just, you know, wasn't quite the regular routine. So getting back into that sleep habit, any recommendations?
Yeah, my children, when they were getting the week before school started, this might be too late for you guys out in the Midwest right now, but when school was coming up, we would start to go to bed a half an hour early, wake up a half an hour earlier, you know, and trying to get them to that bedtime schedule so that when school started, they were on track for that. But it's really important, because we as adults know, oh, okay, we should get 7 to 8 hours of sleep. But our kids need a whole lot more, Neil. So if you have a child between the ages of 6 and 12, the American Pediatric Association says they need between 9 and 12 hours of sleep. And if they're 13 to 18, they still need between 8 and 10 hours. And so that sounds like a whole lot. And what the fallout from that, they're saying, is in middle school, nowadays, 58% of our kids are sleep deprived, and in high school, 73% of them are sleep deprived when it comes to getting that much sleep. So that's a whole lot of very tired children who we're trying to get to pay attention in class and not get in a car accident when they drive to school, our high schoolers. And even things, Neil, like the weight gain that can come on in high school, or even depression, has been tied to our kids having not enough sleep each night.
So I guess when we're talking about, you know, the video generation and screen time, that's one area where we could help our kids and all of us sleep, right, if we just get the screens out of the room.
Absolutely, Neil. Our family has always had a leave your phone in the kitchen policy. So at 10 o'clock, phones go up on the chargers and no one has them in their rooms. And there's no computers in our rooms, and we don't have televisions in our rooms. Maybe we sound Amish, but that's always been something to protect sleep. So sleep is really critical. And for our kids, if their phones are binging and blinging, I hear they're texting each other all the way into 2 in the morning, these high schoolers, and there's no way they're getting good sleep. And there's angst even in some of their conversations that they're having. And so we really need to help protect our children from that sleep robber.
And as you said, I mean, that's when the body heals. I mean, sleep is much more important than we probably realized over the last few years.
It is, Neil. You know, as a physical therapist, I'm treating student athletes often. And I'm finding, more so now than ever before, I'm treating these problems of overuse injuries. And you think, this child is 14. Why would they have an overuse injury? And I think it partly becomes, it's coming from our excessive overtraining that we're doing of young people and never giving them a season off. They go from sport to sport and sometimes 2 sports in a season. But one thing that I believe that I'm seeing a lot of tendon, muscle, and ligament failure is because these children are underslept. And so our bodies heal, our muscles and our ligaments, our nerves, all of those things are being healed while we're sleeping. So if we get 25% less sleep at night, we're getting 25% less restoration. And so we fall prey to injury, accidents, and like I mentioned before, our driving teens, car accidents, because they're sleeping tired.
So let's take a few minutes to talk about one of the other key areas, helping our kids get off to a healthy advantage, and really all of us as well, talking about responsibility, some new habits, study habits, maybe even helping around the house. I know it's sort of shocking, but what do you recommend?
Yeah, you know, I've had friends over the years that we talk about our teenagers, and they tell me how their teens, they can't get them to do any chores around the house, and they're so irresponsible, and the parents are exhausted. And I always ask them, well, did they do chores when they were young? And they said no. And I said, well, why not? And they said, well, we never thought about it. So if you have young kids or young grandkids, start thinking about that. I had my children doing small chores when they were about 4 years old. I would bring their laundry into their room, and I would separate out piles of shirts and shorts and pants, and they would put them in the drawer, or I would ask them, hey, can you go collect me all the garbage pails around the house? I want to throw out the garbage. Or things that they were able to do that were age appropriate, because when it becomes a natural thing that we all live in this home, we all take care of this home, this is God's gift to us, and this is our responsibility. When it starts early, it's not like a cold water in the face when they're 13 and you're asking them to clean their room.
Yeah. And good study habits, too. I mean, kids certainly, even as they get into college, I mean, your kids, 24 and 22, when you get out on your own, you have to figure things out.
Yeah, my daughter is in her third year of medical school, and my son is in his first year of his master's program. And both of them have learned, because, in part I've trained them when they were younger, but they learned to balance study-focused time with recreation time. And that's really important, Neil. So we can't expect our kids to come home from having had to pay attention, for the past 7 hours and make them sit down and do their homework. So it's important that we give our kids a chance to unwind. Really great if they could do something physical rather than just, type into their phones. And then when they come down to study, to give them a block of time. Hey, we're going to eat dinner tonight at 7 o'clock. I'd like you to do your homework starting at 5. One thing, Neil, that I've found with some of my friends' kids who have ADD issues, attention deficit disorder issues, is that rather than make the child sit there and do all of their homework in one period of time, these kids are better off to do a little bit of homework, go out and go move around the house, come back, do a little bit of homework. They even are more successful if you let them bop between subject to subject. So maybe not finish all their math homework straight through, do some of it, then go to English, then come back to math, because the brain of an ADD child likes that movement between different areas of the brain and activity to be more successful.
We've just got about a minute and a half left or so. Any thoughts on, if we go home tonight listening on the way home and we're going to start to implement all these things, and how do we do that without mutiny happening tonight?
Absolutely. It's like boiling a frog, they say. You have to just slowly turn up the heat in the house, in the water. I think that's what we have to do with our kids. That's how I trained or taught my kids how to eat better. I didn't go from white bread to like the heartiest grain. I did a little bit at a time, and I mixed white rice with brown rice bits. And, just each thing has to be small increments. And that's with us also. I think it's really difficult to go cold turkey on anything. But have a goal, an end goal where you want to be, and then break that down into small things. Some people feel like they can't organize their kids because they're not organized. And I think that's a cop-out, because even if you're not an organized person, you understand the nuts and bolts of organization, and you can train your kids to be maybe better at something than you are. I know my kids are a lot better at a bunch of things than I am.
Good words, great advice, great fun to connect. Lisa Marone, physical therapist, author, professor, and speaker, written a number of books, whether it's overeating or headaches or back and neck pain. Get Healthy, for Heaven's Sake, one of her great books. You can find out more, get her Monday morning health tip at lisamarone.com, lisamarone.com. Lisa, always good to visit with you. Blessings to you, and we look forward to chatting again.
Thanks, Neil. Great to be with you today.
Well, you're listening to Faith Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in to the afternoon show. Bill Arnold off this week. I'll be back tomorrow. We'll have another highlight from one of his great previous interviews you want to listen to. And then I'll have a chance to talk with Rob Bluey from the Daily Signal, make a regular visit to us and get updates on the news. And Abdu Murray joining us tomorrow as well during this hour. So hope to see you back tomorrow here on Faith Radio.
Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.